Mormon Transitions podcast was created to promote individual healing and growth, and to prevent or minimize the depression, anxiety, and frustration that often comes with an LDS faith crisis or awakening. It's my ethical obligation as a licensed psychologist to note that what you're about to hear may sound like psychotherapy, but it's not. It is a practical tool to help you make your journey toward authenticity without sacrificing the best parts of your life. Mormon Transitions is a production of the Open Stories Foundation and relies solely upon the support of people like you, its listeners. To help keep the podcast alive or to become a member of the community, please become a monthly subscriber by visiting mormontransitions.org and clicking on the yellow button on the right side of the page under support. All contributions to Mormon Transitions are completely tax deductible and go towards producing the podcast and building communities and programs of support for Mormons like you. Thanks for your support. Hello and welcome to another episode of Mormon Transitions. I'm your host, Christy Money, and my guest tonight is Greg Prince, someone who will be familiar to many of you and who I'm so grateful is coming on tonight. Greg, thank you very much for being here.
Very happy to do it.
Thanks. Now, Greg has been active for decades in scholarly Mormon circles, having written a number of very well-regarded books in Mormon scholarship and history. Most famously, he wrote David O. McKay and the Rise of Modern Mormonism, which was incredibly important in my own faith journey. He co-authored with William Robert Wright that book. And prior to that, he wrote two books on priesthood in the Mormon Church, Having Authority, The Origins and Development of Priesthood During the Ministry of Joseph Smith, and Power from On High, The Development of Mormon Priesthood. And in 2016, he wrote this most recent book called Leonard Arrington and the Writing of Mormon History. He has written extensively for Dialogue, a Journal of Mormon Thought, and served on the board of directors for the Dialogue Foundation. And he was also one of the scholars interviewed at length for the PBS documentary The Mormons, which came out a number of years ago, and also instrumental in my own faith journey. Now, Greg is no stranger to podcasts, having discussed his written work at length on Mormon stories and with Doug Fabrizio on Radio West, as we were just talking about before we started recording. And you've been on A Thoughtful Faith, I think, with Gina Colvin, right?
Yes.
And so today I bring him on particularly to discuss the insights his life experiences and time spent studying church history might bring to Mormons who have gone through a faith transition or journey. And I just love to hear more of your story. So could you tell me more about your own faith journey and how that may have changed over the course of your life?
Yeah, I'll begin by going back to something that you mentioned, and that is the documentary on the Mormons that Helen Whitney did that was broadcast 9 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
I was pulled into it because it was at a time when the McKay biography was in galleyproofs but not yet published, and the head of publications at the University of Utah had sent Helen a copy of the galleyproofs, and that's how we got into contact. So I worked with her for about 2 years, mostly behind the scenes until the end when she put me in front of the camera. But along the way, she said, "So what has your crisis story been?" She said, "Everybody I've talked to has had a crisis story." And I said, "Helen, I guess I'm boring because I can't really conjure up a crisis story. I've come a long way from being very conservative and growing up in a very conservative family to being very not conservative now, but at no point did I sense, at least, that I was going through a faith crisis. I don't know why, but that's the best that I can report."
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, interesting. People refer to it as a lot of different things, and some think a crisis isn't really, you know, an appropriate term. So I hear you on that. I mean, a lot of people talk about a faith awakening, maybe, or just more generally a journey that you mentioned, going from conservative to not so conservative. And yeah, I've heard that a lot too. So what was it like?
Go ahead.
I think that that transition really began when I was in southern Brazil as a missionary. This goes back to the late 1960s. We had a small but vocal group of fairly liberal elders down there, and occasionally at zone conferences or in other venues, they would talk about things that I hadn't heard before. And my reaction was just kind of to shrug my shoulders and say, well, that's interesting. And it really didn't go any farther than that. I think that a metaphor for a transformation that was going on for me was that when I went down to Brazil, I took a copy of Bruce McConkie's Mormon Doctrine. And when I came home, I left it in Brazil.
Mm.
Mm-hmm. So I had already started to figure out, at least, that the approach that Elder McConkie took was not an approach that resonated with me, even though I saw that it resonated with a lot of other people. When I got home, I went almost immediately, within a couple of weeks, into dental school at UCLA. Oh. Now, UCLA in 1969 was a fairly interesting place. University campuses across the country in general in the late 1960s were interesting places. The Vietnam War was in full swing. There was a lot of ferment across the country, and UCLA certainly didn't escape it, nor did the UCLA ward, where I attended for almost 6 years while I was in graduate school there. But again, even though I was exposed to a lot of things that I hadn't encountered before, it didn't bother me. It seemed like it was just part of an awakening process and moving from one room to another in the same house.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I can definitely relate to that. That an awakening, I mean, for some, can be very turbulent. Can signify like maybe there are some scary things ahead, but for others, it seems to be more of a normal process, or just like, oh well, I can see. Well, in the 60s, the country is growing, it's developing, and
I think for me, it was just part of growing up in general. Everybody goes through that transition period during adolescence. That's what adolescence is all about. For some people, that's a tumultuous journey, and for their families, even more so. For me, in general, it was a fairly smooth transition. I just don't remember a real bumpy road, much less any type of an existential crisis. I think one of the things that helped me then and definitely has helped me in all of the intervening years was that I got pulled into science. Mm. When I say I got pulled in, I really had no intention of going that direction when I started in graduate school at UCLA. But in the second year of dental school, the general pathology course was an extraordinary course, and it was that only the 1 year that I happened to take it. Because of the course chairman who only did it that 1 year. And that changed my life. It lit a flame in me that burns to this day. And in a way, it was like a moth to the flame. I was irresistibly attracted to it. My encounter with science as a research pathologist and having practiced experimental pathology for 40 years has equipped me, I think, to deal with questions and transitions in any area of my life in a way that I otherwise would not have been equipped to do.
Hmm. Interesting. Tell me more about that process, how it equipped you.
Well, to distill it all down into one discrete phrase, follow the data.
Hmm.
I have never been led astray in science or in religion by following where the data points led. It can be a discomforting journey, particularly when you hold to one paradigm and then you find out that that paradigm isn't functioning adequately anymore. But getting to the other side, you realize I'm in a better place now, even though it was a rough transition to get there. And I think that insofar as religion can be evaluated on the basis of data, that that's the way that for me it works best to evaluate it. Not all things are data sensitive. And I've not had any trouble in my life figuring out the difference between those things that are and those things that aren't.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
For instance, the existence of God, as far as I can tell, is not going to be very prone to data.
Yeah.
Once you start to get into statements about the attributes of God or the manner in which God interacts with the visible world, then at least you can evaluate some data and say that those data are or are not consistent with that viewpoint of God. But ultimately, you get back to a statement of faith, and you either say, I believe that God exists, or I don't believe, but it's not going to be a statement that's laden with data points.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah. No, that's true, and I'm sure a lot of listeners can relate to that credo to, you know, follow the data. I know I'm at a point, just speaking personally in my life, where I'm content to, you know, let the mystery be. You know, like I one of my favorite songs that I actually use as a bumper in this this podcast, that there's beauty and importance in mystery and myth, but as you were talking about how in your life that how following the data has never led you wrong, that kind of reminded me of how important your book was to my faith journey. Because it really awakened me to the process of policy and doctrinal changes.
Indeed, that was the most surprising thing that I learned in the 10 years that I was working on the McKay biography. How, on the one hand, David O. McKay had been very progressive in trying to change the policy on ordination of black men, and never got to the point where he seemed to want to get, because he felt that it would require a revelation to get there, even though he never considered the policy to be anything other than policy, meaning he did not consider it to be doctrine. And yet equally surprising was how regressive he was on the issue of civil rights. You talk about cognitive dissonance, there it is. But it's true that he was very progressive on the one and very regressive on the other.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you're right. I mean, it really highlighted to me how people, you know, come into this world with and are raised with certain biases, you know, that I mean, as a kid raised in Utah, and I was raised in Southern California, which was like Utah light. you know, I'm sure, you know, President McKay, you know, he had some biases growing up about that, you know, influenced his opinion on civil rights. And it really just blew me away. So thank you for doing all that work, getting down to all those details. Wow.
For giving up 10 years of spare time.
Yeah.
You're welcome.
Yeah. I mean, cause you're a dentist, right? I mean, you were making a living as a dentist and then doing this extensive.
Well, I was doing that part-time. Mm-hmm. I never did it full-time because my second degree was in pathology, and that was really where the passion was and still is. Mm-hmm. Is in biological science, in medical research. So the dentistry was putting bread on the table, but the pathology was making life interesting and challenging.
Ah, I get it. Yeah, very important.
Don't try this at home. It's not a sane way to run a career.
Okay, listeners, take note. Balance is good. But then again, I mean, yeah, that 10 years of sacrifice led to some pretty interesting findings. And so tell me more about your Leonard Arrington book and what's surprised you the most in that book, since we just talked about David O. McKay's.
Yeah, let me give a little segue into it. It and the McKay book are related in that both of them look at men who were at the top of their field within the church. And both men, I think, had a pretty similar outlook, worldview. They are also related in the sense that I didn't go looking for either one of those projects. Bob Wright, the co-author on the McKay book, was the mission president in Washington, D.C., and by a series of flukes, wound up living in our ward, which was the only reason I ever met him, and by a series of other flukes, came to know about the priesthood book that I was working on, and told me one evening when we had him over for dinner that he was the nephew of Claire Middlemas, who was the private secretary to President McKay for 35 years. He said that she had wanted to be the president's biographer and had worked for 35 years in her spare time to compile a record of his life and his ministry, but never had the time to work on it as long as he was alive, and after he died, her health deteriorated quickly. So she gave Bob all of her papers, and Bob said to me, I have two pallets of these papers at my brother's house in Salt Lake City, but I don't know how to write a biography. Will you help me? When I finished the McKay book, my wife said, so what's next? I said, I don't know, but I have a feeling it'll find me. And it didn't take very long for it to find me. The McKay book came out in the spring of 2005. In the fall of 2005, I gave a lecture in Logan on the McKay book. And afterwards, Susan Arrington Madsen, Leonard's daughter, came up to me, introduced herself, and asked if I was available for breakfast the following morning. We talked for about 3 hours, and the bottom line was that she and her brothers liked the McKay biography and wondered if I would be willing to do their father's biography. So I didn't go looking for either one of those biographies. In a very real sense, they found me, and they're linked not only by the mode of origin, but also by the subjects and their prominence within Mormondom.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but, wow. You're right. They did find you.
Yes. And another thing that linked the two of them was that in the case of President McKay, even though it was compiled by his secretary, he left a 40,000-page diary. Leonard Arrington left a 20,000-page diary. When you go through that much firsthand material of two men at the top of their fields within the church, there aren't many surprises left for you. And so it was an unbelievable tutorial to me, lasting 20 years, as to how the church functions at the highest levels. And I think I got a pretty accurate view of what's going on, and somehow managed not to have my faith shaken along the way.
Yeah, that is very interesting. What do you ascribe to, that happening that way? And I don't know also works, but
I think a lot of it goes back again to my training and my career in science. For a period of several years, when I was the CEO of a biotech company back in Maryland, I brought my former mentor back for a month each year to work with some of our junior scientists. He was a retired anatomical pathologist from UCLA and a very good mentor to me and to these younger scientists. But he would come back, spend a month, work at the lab in the day, and then just stayed in his hotel in the evening. I was working on the McKay book at a fairly early stage at that point, and I said, if you're interested, why don't you take a few of these volumes of the diaries? It'll keep you awake at night. He had had enough experience collaborating with a scientist at the University of Utah that this was not a completely foreign language to him, and so he began to read them. After he'd read a few volumes, I said, what do you think? he said, well, if you just change the proper names, this is corporate politics. That was an awakening to me. It didn't really shake me. I just thought, wow, he's right. Another awakening moment was after I had finished going through the 40,000 pages of diaries and had marked the passages that I wanted in my database. The scanning technology wasn't quite good enough then to do it that way, so it was typed in. I did some of it, and my secretary at the laboratory did the rest of it. We put about 7,000 pages single-spaced into the database. At the end, I said, okay, Sonia, I'm the first Mormon you've ever known, so give me your read on this. And she said, well, David O. McKay is my hero. I said, fine, you got that one right. I said, what else? And she said, power corrupts. And I thought, whoa, she doesn't have a dog in this fight, and she's read thousands of pages of this stuff, and isn't it interesting that that is her second response? Well, when you live around people who don't have a dog in the fight, who are making that kind of fairly objective statement, it registers, but it never really shook me up. For me, it seemed to be a seamless transition from one way of looking at the church world into another way of looking at it. The second way has served me well. I don't get unglued when I see people who are performing at a level less than the ideal, because I have this notion that, yeah, they're human beings and they're acting that out. And on a good day, they can rise to another level and do some pretty remarkable things. So if they're not having a good day, they can come and sit on the bench with me. It's a deep bench.
I can see how, you know, that perspective of, you know, follow the data. I mean, you've been researching, you know, these narratives for decades. You saw how corporate politics, you know, went. And so I guess hearing it from an outsider that, you know, power corrupts, you're like, I saw that. maybe that, I'm just thinking off what's the word, just a stream of consciousness thinking, but just that I wonder if you having all that time to process and to study the history, to be that immersed, you know, for decades, maybe helped with the transition, made it go a little bit more smoothly. That, I mean, you had a lot of time to digest, doing so much time that, yeah, that the you were immersed, really.
Unquestionably, yeah. So. Mm-hmm. Getting back to the world of science, we talk about degrees of confidence as it relates to evaluating scientific data.
Right.
What that really boils down to is the more observations you have to evaluate in a data set, the more reliable your conclusion is going to be.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Well, my database encompassed, to begin with, 60,000 pages of diaries and far more pages than that of other archival material. Another thing that added immeasurably to my understanding and my tolerance is that when I embarked on the McKay project, almost from the start, I put the diaries on the shelf and left them there for a couple of years. That was an interesting exercise in self-control, because my inclination was just to dive in and see all of the interesting things that might be there. But it struck me early on that those records weren't going to go anywhere. What was going to go anywhere would be people who knew President McKay, who were old and ready to transition into the next existence. And if I wanted to get their insights, I had to get on that right now and not worry about reading the diaries. So I wound up doing about 200 interviews.
Wow.
on the McKay Project, it surprised me that there were that many people still around who had known him well enough to have something useful to say. Mm-hmm. And in the intervening years, see, I started that project in 1995, so we're 21 years out. My guess, though I haven't gone back and counted, is at least 90% of the people I interviewed are now deceased.
Mm. Wow.
When I did the Arrington biography, I did another 100 interviews. In doing other projects or just in grabbing people along the way who seemed interesting enough that I wanted to get their stories, I've done probably 800 interviews, meaning that I record them and then I do a complete transcript from beginning to end of every interview.
Mm-hmm.
And I do nearly all of that myself.
Really? Oh, wow.
So by the time I had gone through several hundred of those interviews, again, it was like the diaries, there weren't many surprises left. There may be a few details here and there that I didn't know about, but nothing was going to alter the basic narrative, whether it was the McKay biography or the Arrington biography or anything else that's going on. Mm-hmm. So for me, I think key was the combination of having the background in science that really did equip me to make a critical evaluation of data, plus having such a large database that the level of confidence is extremely high.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the mystery of, you know, what goes on in church headquarters was pulled back, I imagine, pretty concretely over all that time.
For me, the curtain isn't just pulled back, it's gone.
Oh, yeah. No curtain at all. As a scientist, then, I imagine you look at things pretty objectively and you can sense when, you experience some of the natural psychological processes that we all go through. I'm thinking of one in particular since you mentioned it earlier, of cognitive dissonance. We talked about how there was some pretty obvious cognitive dissonance for David O. McKay, you know, between how he was feeling about the priesthood and temple ban versus, you know, civil rights, his stance on that. So can you think of any times in your life when maybe you started to feel that that cognitive dissonance in yourself and how you resolved that in your own life?
Well, one of the big ones that I can remember pretty distinctly goes back, oh golly, at least probably 35 years.
Mm-hmm.
It was at a time when there was an extraordinary trio of people, at least two of the three were extraordinary. One was Lester Bush, who has been a friend and a mentor for over 40 years and remains such. The other was Tony Hutchinson, who was a very, very bright graduate student who did his bachelor's and master's degrees at BYU and then came to Catholic University in D.C. to do a doctorate in biblical studies. Particularly over the course of one memorable year, one weeknight every week, the two of them would come to my house for dinner because it was on their way back to their own homes. And we would sit around for the whole evening and kick around what seemed to be the burning topics in Mormon life.
Mm-hmm.
Now, again, this goes back about 35 years. And it's been remarkable to me that there's not been much new discussed ever since then. I see a lot of these online expressions of angst. One of the things that Tony first brought to my consciousness was the challenge of viewing the Book of Mormon as an ancient document. Now, that continues to be a real crisis for a lot of people, enough so that it has driven them right outside of the church. Even though Tony was the one who first presented that, and he was anything but subtle in the way that he did it, it didn't provoke a real crisis of faith in my mind. It was more along the lines of, okay, the paradigm that you accepted until now is sagging because of new data points, so the response as a scientist is not to freak out, it's to say, let's make a new paradigm that better takes into account the new data points. That's the way science is done. You go from old paradigm to new paradigm, and you don't lose a lot of perspiration in the process because that's the way progress happened. So that was probably the one that could have been the most unsettling to me, but it turned out not to be unsettling. And I was able to make that transition, although it was a gradual process, from an ancient to a non-ancient paradigm for the Book of Mormon, and not only not have a crisis along the way, but feel much more comfortable now that my view of the Book of Mormon is consistent with what the reality is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I can relate to that. That's for sure. Yeah,
that still is a biggie for a lot of people. Another biggie for a lot of people is to look at the temple ceremony and then look at Freemasonry and freak out.
Right. Yeah. Tell me about how you processed that.
It turns out that understanding in 1842 of how Freemasonry originated didn't exactly align with how it really did originate, but it was close enough for then. And subsequently, we found out that, in fact, Freemasonry didn't go back to the time of Solomon's Temple. It went back to the 16th century, and it was a trade union that mm-hmm. started in Scotland. Joseph Smith's genius, in my mind, as a religious figure, was A, that he had the vision, and I use that as an encompassing term, not as a single event, but B, and perhaps even as important, he had the ability to translate that vision into a form that was accessible to his believers. Having the vision doesn't get you very far if you can't bring your believers on board.
Yeah.
And he had an amazing ability to translate that vision into tangible symbols. Some of them were verbal, some of them were visual, that resonated with his believers and kept them going and kept the whole tradition going.
Mm-hmm.
That is a very, very rare talent. And he had it in depth.
Oh yeah, no, I agree. I when people say, oh, he was just an uneducated farm boy, he was, wasn't very smart. I mean, and from a psychologist perspective, of course, I can't be in a room with him. I can't, interview him. But just from everything that I've seen, he was a genius. There's hardly a doubt in my mind.
Yes. You can only take from what's available to you. And so the world in which he lived, the air that he breathed, gave him the symbols that he chose to use. He picked and he chose, sometimes it seems in a random fashion, and sometimes he'd pick up something and use it for a while and then lay it back down and go in a different direction. Fine, it's messy, that's the way it happens. I don't have any problem with that. But for him to appropriate the symbology of Freemasonry, to me, if you try to get back into that time and that environment, it makes a lot of sense. It was very powerful symbolism that resonated with those believers for decades and decades. The problem that we have now is that very few people in the church and very few people in the world know or care anything about Freemasonry. And so the richness that was there in those symbols a century and a half ago is mostly missing today. And people wind up scratching their heads saying, what does this mean? And don't really get very good answers.
Yeah, it's true. I was kind of hoping for an essay on, one of the 13 essays on the Masonic symbols and imagery and language in the temple, but so I'd heard that it might be coming, but I have not seen it. And I think they've said that they're done, but I mean, who knows? I guess one might be coming. So that's interesting. So that's how you, yeah, thank you for sharing how, what that process was like for you. Now, you mentioned that for a lot of these issues we've talked about, you know, some people, they leave the church when they find out about it, and you have chosen to stay, and I think that's a very valid option, and it's something, you know, people, you know, they do for, you know, a million different reasons, all of them valid, and so given your choice to stay, do you ever feel that that's a hard road given some of the church policies that are being rolled out right now? I'm thinking of the November policy in particular, and if so, you know, what keeps you going?
Oh, it was a hard road well before the November policy.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
If you are a scientist, particular a biologist, Mormonism is not an easy road for you.
Mm-hmm.
If you are an intellectual, Mormonism is not an easy road for you. If you are a Democrat, Mormonism is not an easy road for you. So I'm 3 for 3 there. And I could probably add others to that list. I think often of a story that I first heard from Leonard Arrington, and it had to do with the subject of one of his biographies, Edwin Woolley. Woolley was a bishop in Salt Lake City for many decades. That was at an era where you could be a bishop for a long time. Elijah Sheets holds the course record. He was bishop for 48 years. But Woolley was a contemporary of Brigham Young, and they were business partners along the way, and one of their business ventures went south, and they lost a lot of money at it. The story is that Brigham saw Woolley on the street one day and said, "So I suppose, Brother Woolley, that you're going to apostatize now." And Woolley's response was, "If this were your church, I would, but it's mine as much as it is yours. I'm staying." Mm-hmm. And that has been a very powerful narrative for me along the way. It also reminds me of a famous episode during Ronald Reagan's 1980 campaign for the presidency, where there was a scuffle in one of the debates, and he said to the well-meaning but not well-performing young man, I paid for that microphone. Well, I paid for that pew too, so why shouldn't I sit in it? I was first exposed to the notion of faith crisis, not because I was having one, but because I was pulled in to help somebody who was having one, and that was Hans Mattson. I was pulled in because a friend of mine had been a Swedish missionary and learned of Hans's dilemma and reached out to him and then asked me to be in the mix, in addition to bringing in a fourth person who was a member of the first Quorum of 70 who agreed to come back to New York. And the four of us sat down and thrashed through some of the problems that Hans was having, and I think, at least for the time being, got him to a much more comfortable and safe place for him. But in anticipation of that meeting, we, meaning several, with me holding a lesser position in it, put together an internet survey that generally became known as the Faith Crisis Survey. There were over 3,000 responses to this, and after all of the statistician types crunched the data, it produced a remarkable picture of what faith crisis really looks like in this church, particularly valuable because it identified in rank order what are the questions, doctrinal or historical, that are tipping people over. And those, not coincidentally, included all of the the topics that have been addressed in the
essays,
church history essays. Yeah.
Yep. That how do you, just out of curiosity, how do you think that those will work? Do you think that they'll be effective? And I mean, the, not to use my own words, to use the words the church has used to inoculate. Do you think that they'll do that, or what's your take on them?
Well, the problem is that there is no one size fits all solution.
Mm-hmm.
We have a broad spectrum of people in the church, but for well over a century, our curriculum materials and the messages from the pulpit didn't acknowledge that variety. If you looked at face value at what was published and what was said, it was targeted towards a monolithic audience and didn't really take into account the diversities of belief, of worldviews, of philosophies of various people within the church. And so the Orthodox viewpoint was essentially the only viewpoint that was offered up.
Yeah.
Now we're at a point where there's enough data out there that orthodoxy is in trouble.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of things that are susceptible to data, in fact, are being evaluated in a way that they were never evaluated before, and they don't hold up very well. So we're in a transitional period. And the people initially who were having the questions were the ones who were following the data.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Those are the ones who I think are the primary target audience for those church history essays. Now, some of the people in that group are satisfied by the essays. Some of them feel that, well, the glass is now half full, but it's not all full. What's the rest of the story? But in trying to solve the problem of those two groups, the church now confronts a problem of its own making, and that is that the very essays that helped one group are turning out to unsettle the Orthodox. And that's why those essays aren't on the homepage at LDS.org. There was a conscious decision to put them deep enough into the website that the Orthodox member who doesn't really want to have to deal with that information won't stumble on it by accident. Now, that's a long way of responding to your question. The shorter answer is those are helpful to some. They are ambivalent in the minds of others, and there's a third group that's upset by them. But there's no simple answer. There's no way of reaching all of those groups, and there are, you could list others besides those three, and satisfying all of them with a single approach.
Yeah, you really can't.
So our move to becoming a more pluralistic church is fraught with a lot of danger. And I don't know what the future holds for that journey.
Me neither. I am hopeful. Most days I'm hopeful. There are a few days in the week where maybe I get a little worried about fundamentalism maybe creeping in and having more of a part in the future. I'm thinking like the next 20 years or so. I think it'll depend on who's in leadership, but I mean, leadership in Salt Lake, not locally, but I don't know. Other days I feel incredibly hopeful about a more pluralistic Mormonism surviving and flourishing.
Well, an irresistible and powerful and irreversible force is the internet. It has been a permanent game changer.
Mm-hmm.
Once those data are out of the bag, they're out. You don't put them back in.
Right.
And so it's going to be increasingly difficult to perpetuate those aspects of orthodoxy that are data sensitive. they're mm-hmm. going to have to be rewritten, or the church will just lose credibility.
Yeah.
Now,
yeah.
It's not impossible for them to take a hard line stance and say either take it as is or leave. I hope that doesn't happen.
Me too.
But it's possible that that could happen. It just depends really on who is making the decisions at the top.
Exactly. Mm-hmm.
If they want to go to a more pluralistic church, I think ultimately that's a healthier environment for all of us, mm-hmm. but it's fraught with a lot of danger to get from point A to point B.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree. I think it's definitely for the best interests of you know, the next generation that are growing up in Mormonism and, you know, living in, let's say, Utah Valley. You know, I'm really hoping that the church will move that way. But like you said, I do think it will depend on who's calling the shots.
we face a double whammy in this church, particularly with our millennials, mm-hmm. because on the one hand, they are in this period of enormous transition, driven in part by the internet, where they are exposed to things that their parents never knew about. Mm-hmm. And probably still wish they didn't know about.
Probably.
but there's a second level of challenge there, and that is that millennials in general, not just within the LDS tradition, tend to be spiritual but not churched.
Yes, I would agree with
that. This is the group that's known as the nones, the N-O-N-E-S, that they don't adhere to any particular religious tradition, and yet very often they are more spiritually inclined than their parents.
Mm-hmm.
And this goes across the board, not just in Christian traditions either.
Right.
That it's becoming more and more difficult for parents to hang on to their kids within their own religious tradition. I've talked a lot to theologians, to clergy in other traditions. I'm on an advisory board at Wesley Theological Seminary in D.C., which is the largest Methodist seminary in the country. They are grappling with it every bit as much as the Mormons are grappling with it, and nobody yet has a good answer for it. Nobody has found the formula that's going to pull these millennials back into church activity.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I agree. I mean, there's no magic formula. I imagine that there are some environments that if they're more pluralistic, they'll at least be maybe a safer place for these, you know, for this next generation or these millennials and the millennials' children to you know, develop spiritually, you know, and if they stay in the tradition or not, at least they'll be safe, if that makes sense. I want for my kids, for example, just speaking personally, I want a place where they can feel like it's okay to have questions. It's that you know, they're accepted exactly the way they are. And I really hope Mormonism goes that route and decides not to do the fundamentalist thing, because I mean, we've as you know, as a historian, that hardly ends well. So
you're right. You're right, and I hope the church does go that direction, but we're not there, not even close to being there yet.
I know. Oh, I know. Well, Greg, it has been a pleasure to talk with you, and thank you for speaking so candidly and you know, about your own experience and your thoughts about, because you've had a fascinating journey. I mean, wow. Talk about following the data, right? You've had all that data on your fingertips for through a lot of hard work. So thank you for doing the hard work and getting that out there for us. Appreciate it.
Well, I hope it's helpful.
Thanks for joining us today on Mormon Transitions. If you enjoyed this episode, please help us make more like it by becoming a subscriber at mormontransitions.org. Music for this episode was provided by Iris Dement.
Some say they're going to a place called glory, and I ain't saying it ain't a fact. But I've heard that I'm on the road to purgatory, and I don't like the sound of that. Well, I believe in love and to live my life. Everybody is wondering what and where.